called Urdu, it used to be called Hindi.
And then they
different script.
You can understand each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's
the script is different.
Is the accent different in some of the slang or dialect?
Yeah, the regions vary and so on.
They don't understand each other.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same language. It's the same language that was then sort of pulled apart.
Right.
Like American English and British English, something like that?
No, it's worse than that, right? It's more like it's spoken exactly the same. We understand each other completely. The scripts were made different, so the Pakistanis made it more Arabized, and the Indians made it more Sanskritized to kind of give them these legacies. And then they have, of course, been adding words which are, you know, driving them further apart. But
in its
history, very recent history, up until 1940, it's the same language. There was, you know, Urdu was Hindi, Hindi was Urdu. Many of our famous poets were, you know, they're quoted saying, "We write Hindi poetry." They didn't say we write Urdu poetry. They said we write Hindi poetry. But it's the same language. Sure. I have some really good papers on the legacies of this divide.
Sure. Isaac, can you talk about Brahman and Abraham?
Why should I?
Because I asked you.
I know, you're taller than me and bigger than me.
The same people,
I think these are very, very diverse. There's no common ethnicity. Very diverse. Yeah. There are dozens of different, if not more, hundreds of different communities.
I want to talk about something more germane.
You know, if you look at the map, Pakistan is actually quite a small part of the map.
Because he needs to hear that.
Even in Pakistan, there are like 6 or 8 different ethnic groups that have lived in these regions for, you know, for millennia.
So India has over 100 languages, right?
India has over like 163 languages. Yeah. At least. And maybe like
at last count.
1,000 variations.
Could be today.
Yeah, it could be today. Exactly.
How many Pakistan?
At least 5 to 6 officially recognized languages.
Yeah. So languages, are they mutual? Are they mutually
incomprehensible? They absolutely can't be.
No, they're just totally different languages.
They're totally different. Totally like Balochi, Sindhi, Punjabi, Pashto, Dari, these are totally different.
Totally different.
There may be roots that are similar, but I don't understand any of these other languages.
You consider French and Spanish to be different languages.
Yeah.
Okay. But they have similar roots.
Yeah.
They're all Romance languages, but yet they've been...
So I see. Listen to this story.
There you go. You're on stage.
Okay, now put a microphone in front of me. I really want to talk about.
No, talk about it because he needs
to hear that.
This is what he needs to hear.
Ghazali and Qawwali music.
Yeah.
Or Qawwali music.
Ghazals and Qawwali music.
No, yes. I was a big fan of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. Yeah. Yes. I'm pretty much the only concerts I ever went to in my life were his concerts. One in twice in Radio City. And
BAM, right? Did he do one at BAM?
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah, oh, yeah?
I think he did a couple of them.
Yeah, I was fascinated by them, and him as a person, and the music itself, and the fact that
brilliant singer,
classically trained, and trained in his own tradition and in classical tradition,
and sung in modern Western as well, very often.
You
know, that's no boundaries.
And the fervor that he brought to his, and just reading about that and actually a friend of mine. I won't mention his name, but right now, because he'll get nervous sometimes when I mention his name. But he knows of. I was speaking to him once about Qawwali music. So he says, "How do you know about Qawwali?" I said, "Well, I read about it, and I went to some of these concerts." I said, "Where did you?" He says, "Well, one time when I was in Pakistan, and I was walking in the mountainous regions, and some guy pulls me in by the arm, and he says, 'Hey, come come to this bonfire over here, and we have.'" And then he came, and they were singing throughout the night. And
right,
I thought,
right.
So that's how he knows about it. He's also the same guy who fought with the Mujahideen against the Soviets in Afghanistan in 1982.
And it's a Jew.
He happens to be a Jewish guy. He lives a few blocks away from here, yes. Anyway, so to me the most fascinating about him is and what an average Westerner can't comprehend, I think, is the amount of religious fervor, I guess, that can accompany, you know, to sing a song for an hour at a time. I mean, in the United States, you sing a song for 3 minutes or 4 minutes.
Right.
You sing the same song for an hour and get into it till the point where I didn't totally understand this, and maybe you'll help me out with this, is that at least in one description, somebody was saying that where people will hurl themselves to their deaths in religious ecstasy.
Yeah, it's a trance. They are in trance. They also use things to help them get to a trance.
Okay,
It's very common. embossed on and shrunk.
Well, same thing in the observant in the Jewish.
Well, the dervishes too.
Yeah,
well, I mean, you know, just the singing is very trance.
Right, spinning. In,
and you'd see that in Bach's
song. But it's a chant.
It's a trance, yeah. And they also use, you know, various
exotica to help them enhance the situation.
Absolutely.
Yes. And they are Sufi.
They are, yes, they are.
The dervishes Sufi, as well are Sufi.
They're Sufi bhakti traditions, which are Hindu. They have the roots in Hindu devotional practices, actually.
And what kind of practices?
Hindu devotional practices.
Bhakti.
Yeah, it's called a bhakti movement, which is emerges actually out of South India. And that's how really the Islam actually spreads in India, is through this commonality between the singing, dancing form of worship. So if you go to
what year
festivals,
because it's pre-Sufi or post-Sufi?
Yeah, it's pre-Sufi.
Even pre-Sufi.
Yeah, it's pre-Sufi.
So you want to say that maybe even Sufism itself is strongly influenced and is able to.
I am saying that. Not maybe. I am saying that.
No, but you're saying Sufi in general or Sufi only in India?
In India.
You're not saying it.
I mean, there's no one common. There are many different methods to it, and it has different origins. But these Sufi saints that have came to India from, and they came primarily from Central Asia.
Yes.
Their particular songs, their the music, the form of dance and music practice is very much influenced by Hindu devotion practices.
Directly.
And they, in India, as lived traditions, they mix very, very comfortably. So you will not see, you can go to many shrines. This was part of my first project in India where I explored these shared traditions. But you have Muslim singers in Hindu temples, and you have many Hindu worshippers at Sufi shrines all over India. In fact, majority in a Sufi shrine would actually be Hindus at any given point.
And they're accorded what type
of
respect
equality.
And equality?
Absolute. I recall.
Fascinating.
I have photographed. I mean, this was my first India project. It's called The Idea of India, which explores anyone can arrive at a Sufi shrine, anyone. And they will be walked through all the appropriate rituals that they want to perform. Actually, in fact, if you look at the most sacred shrine, which is Ajmer, Hindus were even caretakers of that shrine, and it is to a Muslim saint.
Right.
So, by law, and this was a court case was filed during the Mughal period, because the existing cohort of caretakers insisted that only Muslims can take care of this place.
Right.
The Hindus filed a court, and the Mughal courts decided against the Muslim court. I said, no, actually, this is an Indian shrine universally. He is a saint to all Indians.
Really?
So you can have non-Muslims who can be caretakers to the shrine. So
Shabbos courts.
It was an 1857 court. It was an 1857.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I do want to thank
very
you.
Very nice meeting you.
Really
thank
enjoyed
you.
Your presentation.
Thank you so much for coming. Yeah. Thank you for your questions.
No, thank you for your presentation very much. And thank you for your
hospitality. Always. Thank you so much for coming, as always.
We'll come again.
Please. We're here tomorrow night, as you well know.
But one of the things...
I'll send you a link to my India project.
Oh, please.
It has a bunch of essays.
Oh, please. Oh,
but there's a rich... exchange.
Interaction and exchange.
Between these two.
Thank you for that. Yeah,
lots of. I mean, to a degree that would actually surprise you, but there's a lot up until even 1946. So Abu Kalam Azad, who is one of the great independence leaders of India, when in prison, he was writing a book at the same time as Nehru was writing a book. One of his chapters explores the shared spiritual legacies of the Quran and the Bhagavad Gita. This is in 1946 by a very devout, very conservative Muslim political leader.
Right.
So the Muslims of India have always engaged very deeply with Indic histories. In fact, right now at the Sackler Gallery in D.C. is an entire exhibition on yoga, which has been painted by Mughal-era artists. And in fact, there was a review in the New York Review of Books which actually talks about how a lot of the yoga that we practice today emerged because the Mughals were very fascinated by these practices, and they started to put them into print.
They started to paint, draw, and grab them.
So it's a fascinating exhibition, which I'm going to see when I come back in April, but because I don't have time right now. But I think it's another example of this very sort of sharing and openness to, you know, to which was one of the aspects of my project that I've been exploring, because there's this belief that you know, we are so far apart and so
on.
But it's contrary to our heritage.
I didn't know, as much as you're saying, sure.
It's contrary to our heritage.
I mean, absolutely. You have it all over. You have when Christianity comes to South America.
Right.
So all of a sudden, there's all these saints coming into, which were not so common in its European sojourn.
And they come into Islam as well. There was this wonderful book written called The Barbarian Plain. It's written by a Greek-American historian, and she studies the frontier between the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire. And there emerge all these cults to Christian saints, to St. George and St. I'm forgetting his name now. St. George and St. I will send you a link to the book. But she has graphic. In fact, it's one of the first essays I wrote on my India project, because I was that photo that it's a drawing schematic which actually inspired this. It's a schematic of a mosque and church that are built together in the same complex. The Muslims entered on this side, the Christians prayed on the altar one side, and in between was a shared common
courtyard
where they would mingle after. And there's a whole history to this. It's in the city of Rusafa in Syria. So the building, the ruins still exist. And she explored this. And in fact, even today in Istanbul, there's a shrine to St. George that Muslims go to. And then, of course, all over Syria, there were shrines, Christian shrines that Muslims went to and prayed at and tied threads at. Under the Orthodox church and so on. So there are all these legacies that we have forgotten or have been untaught by our modern histories and so
100%,
on.
I mean,
but when you dig,
you find
all this shared.
Well, some people, it goes so generally as there are some who want to say that the birthplace of Buddhism is, of course, is India, but you can't find a Buddhist under any rock.
Yeah.
And some the theory, I guess, is that Hinduism moved so much to Buddhism that it wasn't necessary to have Buddhism as a separate thing.
Yeah.
So
but
again,
there was also a lot of violence.
And they were decimated.
Yeah, there was. There was a lot of...
So that's a nice theory, but in practice...
No, Hinduism did adopt a lot of the ideals of Buddhism. So absolutely. But there was also a lot of violence.
Right, that helped.
Yeah, that helped.
Exactly.
There was a lot of internecine violence between... Again, Hinduism is a constructed... It's not a religion as such, right? Hinduism is this name given to everything that wasn't Islam, that wasn't Judaism, that wasn't Christianity.
Right.
So everything else got lumped in. But there was a lot of...
That's a very important point.
It is a very important point.
Say that again to me, please.
Hinduism is a 19th century construction.
Yes.
There is no such one religion as Hinduism.
Right.
It was the name given to this entire sort of panoply of practices that existed in India that were non-monotheistic.
Right.
By the British,
or unrecognizable,
not
conventional. So
right. And the convention being defined by the British evangelicals as one, as a monotheistic,
Judeo-Christian
faith. Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you saw Islam, I recognize that. If you see a Christian, I recognize. If you see a Jew, I recognize that.
Oh, you're...
What the hell are these people doing? That became something else. And then there's a reform movement, and Hinduism is constructed. I have some essays on that as well.
Oh, wonderful.
And then, but within India, and this conflict continues, because you will see that there are even the books, there are certain entities that are gods in one part of India, but they're not gods in the other part, like Ram. So Ram, who is the main focus of the Hindu rite, is a god in the Ramayana on the east of India. But in Bengal, he's actually just a soldier in the same book. He's not a god. So this diversity of practice. So there was a lot of conflict within these other communities that because of the plurality of religious practice in India, which remains incredibly diverse. And so on.
So when someone speaks about Hinduism,
they're speaking about it. Thank you very much for coming.
When somebody speaks about Hinduism, it's not only a misnomer,
it's a modern construct. They're building a new religion that will look more like an Orthodox. That was the intent in the 19th century to produce a recognized...
It was a conscious attempt.
It is a conscious attempt.
Wasn't it?
By and also Hindu reformers, Brahmin reformers of the 19th century, who wanted equal respect with these other faiths.
It was internally because of an external pressure.
Absolutely.
It wasn't like an internal
desire to... Exactly. There was a desire to have a religion that could stand alongside the others, that our practice should have the same respect and value as all these other religions. There was also, by the way, a reform movement in Islam. A new kind of Islam was all Muslim practice
Islam
in India
not
was...
Hindu. Hindu is not Islam. They look alike. They vegetarian, they believe in cows, and they believe in Allah and Muhammad.
Please. If you want to jump into a conversation, I really want
you to. I studied by religion.
I know you did. I'm sure you did.
We should be going. It's like late. It's like way past my bedtime.
Are you going?
Are you Hindu or are you
I'm Muslim. I'm a Kashmiri Muslim, North India.
I studied about all religions.
That's wonderful.
Definitely. I like this.
Are you a member of the synagogue?
What?
Are you a member of the synagogue?
I'm not a member of the synagogue.
No one's a member?
Except for me.
You are.
I'm the only one because I was in this synagogue.
And we're going to leave you here, too.
Right.
In one of the walls.
I was in the synagogue in the womb.
Okay.
In the what?
In the womb.
Okay.
So,
my mother.
Strangely interrupted.
Right. Yeah, so there are these very powerful reform, religious reform.
You were about to say right. Yes, you said you were
which
saying
which affect Muslims, which affect Hindus.
What was the reform movement within Islam? You were saying.
Making it a more unitary, more textually correct faith.
Well, you're not talking about al-Wahhab.
No. I'm talking about
who wanted to go to a Puritanical.
No,
because he wanted to go back to
sure.
what way it was.
No, it was more around the fact that again you have because of the Sufi practice. You have a very wide practice of Islamic religious practice in India. So, like as Kashmiris, we have a very different connection.
How about the Sharia law? The Sharia law? Sharia law?
There is no Sharia law.
Oh, yeah, there is.
Where?
All over.
No. There isn't.
No?
No. It's not that straightforward. So, for example, like there are elements of Sharia in the constitution that would have been put there, but no, there is no Sharia law nation anywhere.
You wouldn't say that Saudi Arabia is a Sharia law?
Yeah, Muslim.
See, the problem is because Sharia is a process of arriving at a jurisprudence, and it's not consistent. So we don't agree with it. Like that interpretation, we would disagree with.
No, but it's as a construct of a way to view jurisprudence.
Yeah, they can label it Sharia if they want, but the Iranians disagree with it and they contest half of it, and the Pakistanis disagree
fine.
With it.
That's okay. It doesn't mean that it isn't Sharia.
Yeah, it's a method of jurisprudence, like we have. Okay. So they have a heritage of precedents that they look at and so on, and
sure,
they arrive at.
Sure.
But what you arrive at is going to be very different than, say, another community of people would arrive at looking at similar precedences. So there's a great diversity of interpretation.
Coming from a Jewish perspective, that's totally fine.
Yeah.
In other words, if your attempt is to arrive at something with the best tools that you have from the experiences that you gained within your life and your community's life, that's fine.
Yeah. But then what you arrive at is not necessarily because it incorporates a lot of other things. So, for example, suppressing freedom of speech in Saudi Arabia has nothing to do with Sharia, but there are lots of laws about it.
True, but
you see what I mean?
That goes back to us, the very terrible fact that we're human.
No, I understand, but that's what I mean. So what you have on paper,
so
for example, in Dubai, they claim that they have Sharia law, but which I find amusing because their law says, okay, you can't be found kissing on the beach, but they encourage the largest number of prostitutes in the Middle East, anywhere in the world, because it's good for business. So what is it that you're...
Well, now you're talking something else. Now you're talking about law and business.
That's what I mean. What is it that you are applying and not applying? Because it's one thing you're not applying and saying, hey,
you're asking way too much.
I know. But I go to Dubai and I ask these questions that you threw in jail, like two adults who were holding hands and kissing on a beach at night for like 12 years. And I go to a bar and I can't go there with like my wife because you are happily importing, Russian prostitutes because the American soldiers who are going to come and spend money here want that.
Right.
And so it's all by, the same people.
Well, yes, but it's also the other.
Who's the other?
The
other is like in American law, we're terribly against cigarettes. Right? Okay. But American commerce, whatever you call it, they go and try to expand cigarette smoking amongst anybody they can outside of the United States.
Right.
Okay.
That's what I mean. So then
you're questioning hypocrisy.
Yeah, exactly. So then you have these
Gee,
laws.
Man.
They'll claim to the citizenry, okay, we're following Sharia. But you're like, okay,
Your bar is very high.
Yeah. My bar is high. It's called consistency. You know, I just want, you know.
Since when did that apply to anywhere, to anybody? Come on. We need to get this guy.
I know, it's just random.
That's why I brought him.
But no, I hope you understand that. I'm 82% kidding and being silly. But it's
But I will send you some stuff on the reform movements in Islam and Hinduism. And Pankaj Mishra has written a bunch of stuff about that also.
I'd like to see that. I mean, sometimes I find that, for instance, you ask somebody, what, you know, do Hindus believe is Hinduism monotheistic?
Right.
And some people say, of course not.
They have they're constructing that.
And other people tell you that it is monotheistic. And they'll tell you, well, the practitioners of it, your average Joe Sixpack, will think that it's not monotheistic.
Right.
But if you speak to a scholar, you speak to a theologian of can you say theologian in Hinduism?
Yeah.
I mean, it's theo. It's not.
But that's the construction. They would like to claim that Ram is the ultimate god. In the South, they will claim that Shiva is. There is an attempt to construct this kind of.
So in other words, but I could also see something else that Hinduism, being that Hinduism is not Hinduism. Because it is not monolithic, and it's not one thing, and there are 27, 55, or whatever it is, Hinduism. So maybe, one Hinduism actually does believe in monotheism, and another Hinduism doesn't.
You will meet a lot of Indians who will say that. You will meet a lot of Hindus who will argue that they are regional-specific practices, they are vernacular to their region, and that their practice is something called Hinduism, and it's different from the guy over there, and it's fine. In the pantheon of Hindu philosophy and world view, all of this is acceptable. There's no reason to put it under one umbrella.
But is it then Hindu? Or maybe it's each thing is different.
But that's the label we have right now, right? So, yes, each thing could be labeled differently.
But maybe it should.
Maybe
they're different religions.
Right now, under the National Religious Project of India, it will not be labeled differently. They would like to incorporate it and cleanse it of its ugly, you know, strands. So, like, for example, you know, Wendy Doniger's book, the Chicago professor's book, has been banned in India by the Hindu right. Why? Because her book shows you that there is this incredible complexity and diversity of practice, and they hate that. They banned the book called 300 Ramayanas, which I wrote about in my India project book, which showed you that the Ramayana, which the Hindus would like to revere as the Torah or the Quran, the one book, has been interpreted and read and seen and written in different ways by over 400 different communities in India. There are many versions of it, and that's the reality of it. And the Hindu right fundamentally hates that. They would like to get rid of all of them and accept only one, Valmiki's Ramayana, which was written in Ayodhya in the 12th century. So it's a construction. There's an effort to cleanse it, make it monotheistic, make it more like a religion that all of us can recognize. This is a project.
Wow.
And there are names. You can put names to it. Vivekananda, and you know, there are specific names. Reformers, as they were reformers in 19th century Islam in India. Yeah. These were reactionary movements to colonial rule and to the denigration of the colonized. And, you know, like you had negritude in Africa, if you remember. You said black is ugly. They got up to know black is beautiful. These reactionary, you know, anti-colonialist things. And this is what happened in India as well.
Thank you for teaching me that.
There's a lot of, I mean, there's amazing work done by Bernard Cohen here at Chicago, and Richard Davis has done some beautiful work. He's teaching, I forget where he's teaching. And, you know, most any serious Indian academic will tell you, yeah, that's what it is. I mean, they know. Partha Chatterjee has written about it, Ashish Anand, lots of them.
Right.
But they're great histories. I mean, and these are also very important for... I write about them because I'm trying to get Pakistanis to understand that, you know, what you are practicing today is also a construction, that there were variations and varieties in Islamic religious practice in India, which are very different from the Middle East. Our Islamic practices as culture, as lived practices, are very different from what you do in Syria and other places, or Chechnya and so on. But people want to forget that. They would like to think that, no, it's the same. It's a real, you know...
I mean, Central Asian Islam, you see how the East, you know, how that permeates the way that it's...
And for, like, us Kashmiris, that's the main influence. Central Asian Islam is our predominant influence in the northeast of the country, in the mountain regions. It's not the Middle East or the Arab deserts. So, I mean, I'm named Asim, which is a Turkish name. It's not really an Arabic name. Right. So, you know, so our lineages are more interesting than, and this whole linkage to the Middle East. This is a construction. It started in the 1980s.
Linkage of
the belief that our heritage, ethnically, religiously, all emerges from the Arab desert.
Why would people think that?
Yeah, everybody thinks that. That's the heritage that was. That's the story of the. This is the thing that we talked about. The Sunnification of Pakistan in 1980. This was the project. The project was to show that Pakistan's legacy actually is not from India, from those heathens, or from the north. It's from the Middle East, which is not true at all. But it's a political project.
Mm. I mean, does that even begin? I mean, standing outside of it all, does it even begin to make any sense?
I know that, but you will be surprised. People buy into a lot of things. You just need to really work on it.
Wow. That's...
Sadia Thur is a Pakistani professor here. She's written a book which, you know, one portion of that talks about that particular project in the 1980s to create greater affinity in people's memories and histories with the Middle East and sort of disconnect them from, you know, the uglier, messier reality of being connected to India and Central Asia.
I think I'm missing something because it just sounds wild. It just sounds too wild to...
It's where, you know,
there's no question that religion-wise, religion does come from, sweeps down from the Middle East.
But people believe that they trace their genealogy to, actually.
Well, there are X amount of people that did come from there. But, I mean, if you look at the vast majority, you have to be forgetting about
You will see lots of names in India that have the word Sayyid in it, S-Y-E-D. That rubric actually means that you're a direct descendant of the Prophet's family.
That's interesting. I know many Jewish guys named Sayyid.
Right. So if you total up all the Sayyids, you go like, okay, guys, I'm sorry, 89%, 90% of you are not. This is not your lineage. It cannot be.
Well, it you know, you like what is it called? Pseudepigraphia. You ascribe this work to somebody else, much more important than yourself, because nobody would buy your book. So
basking in the glory of something,
of some prestigious aristocratic name.
Interesting. These are political projects.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, Pakistan one is very easy to explore because there's this there's a particular Arab invader by the name of Mohammed bin Qasim. They raided into the regions of Balochistan. We're talking about 7th, 8th century. It was only the 1980s that he becomes kind of a national hero for the country. Prior to that, he's a non-entity in the historiography of South Asia. In the 1980s, suddenly he becomes like the founding father. It's a part of a project to turn our attention down towards this Arab lineage. And by the way, I didn't even get it all the way into Pakistan. He only got into like Balochistan and then went back. But it becomes very, very important, you know, because as a political project.
Interesting. What's interesting is, of course, that, you know, one equates in the conventional perspective, one equates Islam with Arab, and Arab with Islam, and it's only really a one-way street because most Muslims are not Arab.
Not Arab at all.
The vast majority are not Arab at all.
If you look at their legacies, like if you go all the way to Indonesia, it's very much colored by Hinduism. Even now, like they have, you know, their decorative marquees tend to be Hindu gods, and you know, so very, very. In fact, cleansing Indonesian Islam was a very big part of their post-independence project. Because up until 1957, it was a very Hinduic practice of Islam. So very spirits and tree spirits and things like that. So.
Well, in art, I mean, again, and I know nothing. But in being that there is a prohibition almost to art of any depiction of animals or humans, whatever, it all becomes geometric designs and stuff like that. And great borrowings from Persia, from India, there is no real. I mean, I don't want to start. I'm not going to denigrate and say, well, the original Muslims were these poor Arabs who didn't have any culture.
I'll leave that for some of the scholars to say. But it's part of our Muslim historiography. It's a recognition that the religion becomes a culture when it arrives and connects with the Persians, with the Indians, what have you. So that's, you know, I mean, Cordoba didn't emerge on its own. I mean, it's part of this whole process, that the apotheosis of these incredible civilizations are a result of this intermixing with the other societies. And the Iranians have a grand heritage of art and depicting the Prophet, even. So they will paint the Prophet, which is right. Blasphemous in other parts of the world. The Mughals have a rich tradition of human animal art, what have you. So that taboo stays in the desert, so to speak. And in some ways, we should be grateful, because out of the geometric calligraphy emerged algebra. So we shouldn't denigrate that, because they used it to calculate the precision of the calligraphy.
It's an aside, I know, but when you say emerges, algebra emerges from that.
Yeah, because they had to calculate with great precision.
Right.
Through the architecture and the actual, creation of the tiles and everything had to be prepared and measured. So there was this need for sophisticated mathematics, and as they were doing the architectural designs, through which the algebra, which is al-jabr, emerges.
Even the numbers are Arabic.
Even the numbers are Arabic. Yeah. But it comes from.
Are they truly? Or are they Indian?
They could be Indian. That's true.
Awesome.
Actually, but certainly the zero is Indian. So that's the great.
Oh, it is? I thought it was Arabic.
No, the zero is Indian, for sure.
Thanks.
The greatest, probably the greatest achievement. They came up with a zero. Anyway, I think, again, and as you go towards Indonesia, the artistic depictions become very, very Indic. Lots of goddesses, dragons, and Chinese influence and so on, which all is still there, basically. It had to be modified, modernized, so to speak. But... It's a very Hindu
style. Do you want a cup of iced tea or
no? No, I'm good. We should be going.
Okay. Well, I have one question. I have one question. That's for Isaac. Talk to you.
Oh, about Brahman and Abraham.
Right.
I don't know what the old man wants, but
humor me.
Brahman and Abraham.
There are those, and I don't know who those are. It's all of them, but some people who want to say that there's a connection between. Hinduism and early Jewish, Israelite, Hebrew religion. Yes, and in some of the words that maybe what one is influenced by the other. Some of the words you could, right. Abraham, Brahmin, etc., etc. And there's various other. I don't know.
But it's polytheistic. It's polytheistic. No, Vishnu, Shiva.
Yeah, it is.
Like Greek religion.
But Abraham and Brahman. Go on.
That's it. What do you want? Abraham, Brahman sounds
what else
like.
Did he bring?
He's asking. He wants.
What is it? What is Brahman?
You want me to make something up on the spot?
Yeah.
I have no idea what you want.
No, I'm just wondering. But what else do they bring? What else is similar?
I don't know. I don't know.
What else is similar between Muslim and.
Muslim and Jewish?
Yeah.
There's plenty of things.
But also Indian. In the Brahmin and the Jew and the Jew and Abraham, what is similar in that? That they just got brought his name. Where is this?
Well, no, but you have to be careful, because Brahmin is a modern, verbiage. So it just may sound similar. I haven't looked into it, but I don't think Abraham was called Abraham. What was his real name? Must have been something different, right? What was his
Abraham?
Abraham.
Yeah, I mean they wouldn't have called him Abraham.
His friends called him Abraham.
But with a different tone.
Honestly. No, we really don't know. One of the things that, let's say, all alphabets in the world today come from the Phoenician Hebrew, right? But the Phoenician Hebrew/Hebrew didn't have vowels as letters. The Greeks put that in, pretty much, right? I think. So when you say a word, you don't know what the
origin,
vocalization of it would be. So Abraham could have been Ibrahim. It could have been Uber Rahumo.
The consonants you have. Is often an Arabic.
Yeah, Ibrahim, but comes from Abraham. That's just the Arabic version of Abraham.
Right.
Brahman. The Old Testament is
But I'm curious about this Brahmin element, because the Brahmins are...
the
we'll have to go and Google that somewhere and figure it out.
No, but he's Abraham the only one who knows.
No, I don't know anything. I made it up possibly for you on the spot.
I know, that's why I asked you.
There are two things.
Do you live in New York or where do you live?
Well, now I'm living in Rwanda.
In Rwanda.
I used to live
so
in
he knows Taylor.
Oh, you know Taylor?
Yeah, yeah, Taylor Crowley's out.
Yeah.
Fine fellow.
So he spoke here, too.
Ah, okay.
He has something, one of the things of doing individual stories.
Yeah, he's doing oral testimonies.
Oral testimonies, yeah. I think.
He's being interviewed by a friend of mine this week for Worst Case Magazine. It's an online magazine.
We have to hook up with him again, I think.
Yeah, no, he won't.
He's Don Cheadle should win the Oscar for Hotel Rwanda, I thought.
You think so? I didn't like that movie at all.
No, it seems so. He was so emotional and so caught between the Hutus and the Tutsis. And Ray won it. What's it called? Jamie Foxx won.
But let off the hook all the international powers that were so deeply involved in it.
Why it was?
Let off the hook.
Yeah, the French, the Belgium, they're all part of this nonsense.
Yeah, Belgium's all guilty, including the United States.
No, but I mean, the French armed this government to the last minute. For the last minute, they were flying.
That's such a big country, France.
You know, they're. Well, you know, the UN sat on his ass, like doing nothing. They knew what was going on. They're like, oh, what the hell with the Africans?
Well, there was this wonderful book. Forgive me, but for tomorrow, I will die.
Yeah, that's right. We wish to inform you that tomorrow we. But that was Gurwitch's book. But if you read, General Dallaire's book, the UN commander who stayed behind. I mean, it's unbelievable to read what happened.
General Dallaire.
It's
called Shaking Hands with the Devil. And it's his story on the
inside. He wanted to kill a guy who came into him with blood on his clothes fresh blood.
He's the commander of the UN forces that were abandoned there by the UN. They left him. They said, no, you're not going to do anything. You're going to just stand there. Moment of the genocide, 94. He was there watching it unfold and the UN saying, hey, you're not doing anything.
How many were killed? Millions?
They estimate 800,000 in a month.
In a month.
I must say...
The numbers are probably higher.
We're moving to... You're saying what the numbers are?
I think the numbers are much higher than that.
Much higher than
800,000.
You're saying that... I can't wrap my mind around that. The amount of... the lack of systemic, I mean, you want to compare it to, one needn't compare it, one shouldn't compare this to anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
But just if you speak about Cambodia, if you want to speak about the Nazi Germany, if you speak about, there's a certain
former
systemization.
Contestable. I contest that one.
Okay, we'll talk more about that.
There's a certain systemization, there's a certain amount of high, top down.
But Rwanda had that.
It had, as far as influencing and saying, okay, on the radio all that.
Yeah.
But the actual butchery
was done by individuals, by hand and by knives. Yeah. We look at the videos.
But if you notice how governments work, they'll come in, like the colonizers, and they'll arm the weaker country to be the rulers over the regional.
I get that.
Group.
I'm just saying the fact that neighbor to neighbor, the fact
husband
of...
Husband to wife.
It was happening the same thing in Bosnia, though.
No, but there's an issue of... Well, the issue of scale,
scale, brutality, and also there you had a certain... You had leaders there. If it was not Milosevic, if it was guys with the... I mean... But here it wasn't that. It was neighbor to neighbor. It was butchery with machetes.
As barbaric as you can get.
Yeah, as raw as you can.
Raw, barbaric, immediate.
So what do we learn from this?
And the church was a big part of it.
Yeah. Both.
Yep. The Catholic Church was a big part of the genocide.
Why? What did they have to...
Yes, fomenting it. They don't... That's the question we would ask, but they... many of the memorials in Rwanda are churches where the bodies have been left intact. They were responsible for giving people shelter and then unleashing the militia on them or locking them in churches.
Oh, no. That's almost like the gas chambers.
Many of the main memorials in Rwanda are these old churches. And they've left the bodies and everything is still there. They preserve the cadavers and the corpses inside the pews and so on. To remind you that your leaders failed you, your religion failed you, your faith failed you, and it's the Catholic Church and
it wasn't so much the interest. They were in bed with power. Actually, kind of like the Vatican, you know, with the Nazis.
That, I mean,
don't go there, right?
But no. Go there. No, 100%.
The Vatican with the Nazis and the Catholic Church with the...
The Vatican's and the Nazis were together?
Yeah, the Vatican's justified all sorts of... I'm sorry, I will say it. The Vatican justified all sorts of expulsions and targeting of Jews in Europe during that period. And never really spoke out about what was happening.
They might even have the menorah, no?
It goes two ways. I mean, historically, if you look at it... listen, I'm not going to make any excuses for the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, but if you see and if you tease it apart, oftentimes, you know, when you had the flagellants, not the flatulence, but the flagellants. Yes. So they went around, and what do? If you want to appease God and you want to somehow, you know, expiate your own sins, and you got to kill a few Jews, which is understandable, of course. It's good to know. Yeah.
The lesson for life.
Yeah, sure. So the Pope, I think it was then, and again maybe, by the Black Death, by the Black Plague, the Church had to say, no, Jews are dying just like anybody else.
1,000 years ago.
No, 600 years ago. Whatever it was, 700 years ago. And therefore, don't target them, and don't think that they're... Right. So the Pope actually did oftentimes protect Jews. I mean, it's part of Christian theology.
Sure.
That you have to have a remnant of Jews around that Jesus be able to come back
But then more than who's going to be the bankers? The Jews are always going to end up being the bankers.
I do hold our spiritual leadership to a higher standard of universal ethics because of the powerful influence they have in communities. And in these instances, and you know, I do hold the Vatican very much. I mean, they still haven't apologized for their role in the collusion and collaboration. And it was collusion and collaboration. They may save a few for the day of reckoning. And the Church in Rwanda did the same. They were in bed with power, protecting their interests, financial and others, and said nothing. And felt that, you know, we will always side with power. This is one of the problems with institutionalized religion. It gets seduced by power.
Look at one equates, at least the Americans would like to equate Buddhism with peace.
Yeah.
And, you know...
Sure, so peace.
What happened in Japan during World War II?
What's happening in Sri Lanka and in Burma right now with the Buddhists?
In Tamil?
Yeah, in Tamil Nadu. I mean, it's...
In the name of the Buddha.
That was a war
between the Sri Lankans, who were Buddhists, and the
Sinhalese and the Tamils.
Yeah. They were both Buddhists. There was the name of it. So I have a website, it's called idiocracy.com, and it's because big business is king, government is queen, and media and religion are the mistress, because they go wherever power is.
Mistress.
I'm not a religious man.
You're not. Let's try to make it.
I try to be a moral person without having to.
Can I get you drink?
Alcohol? No, thank you so much. I'm good. I'm trying to get to bed, but clearly that's not going to happen. Clearly my need for a...
He doesn't even go to sleep until 5 o'clock. And look at these guys over here. I wish.
Religion is, institutionalized religion is can be a very dangerous, dangerous thing. As one who is part of the, not establishment, somewhat of the establishment.
You're a Judas.
I'm a Judas.
He's a Judas, which is a Jew Buddhist.
I look at religion like this. It's like when you buy something new, you get instructions, and you have to read the instructions how to use it. Now, I know my instructions. So I'm religious my own way. Mm. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? So I don't.
This is the way it's supposed to work.
Oh, the Torah or the Bible or the Quran, whatever you want to call it. Okay, instruction how to behave and how to guide life. You know what I mean? But
no, he doesn't.
Especially in the Judaism, the Torah, every single word is on top of something else. That's what they meant, that's what we wanted, that's what 3 times, 5 times the meaning of this and the meaning of that.
So that's how I look at it.
But I believe in God. I respect the religion, I respect the Hasidic people, the payers, I respect Muslims, I respect Hindus, I know all about the religion. I know the five pillars of Muslim. You gotta go to Mecca. One is Mecca. One is Tzedakah. You know Tzedakah?
Why? I'm not sure. You have to explain to me later on why you're saying this.
We're trying to figure out why he's a Judas.
What's the Judas? He wants to say that I am a turncoat.
Oh, you're a Buddhist mixed in.
Oh, I don't know what. Go try to enter the mind of Gio.
He's Judas, yes.
But is that what you're trying? I'm a turncoat?
No, I wasn't. I was just saying that
Judas isn't Judas.
Is more Buddhist than
Jew? I don't know.
No, than what he looks like.
I'm just here to poke fun at you. That's it.
And
you make my job so easy. That's the problem. But of course, with great respect and love.
Right, of course. Always.
Well, he's recording.
Are you recording? No.
Otherwise.
How do you do with this recording?
But anyway, that's.
I don't know. Hold on, I'll take it.
You were saying something before. Like I said, we were so comically interrupted. I forgot what the thing about
usually institutionalized religion
and
power.
What's fascinating to me about the reform movements? So I forgot the names of them. One was Al Wahhab, and the other one was Al with a T sound. Oh my, I'm losing my mind. But anyway, so to some people, and again in the West we don't appreciate. I think most people don't appreciate this. Is that the Wahhabis are considered heretics by many because they want to go to a what they feel is a purer, you know, form. They want to go back, right? But what do you do then with all the generations in between then? Are you then accusing them of being mistaken? And we know they were all the great imams, so you're implying that they were... So therefore,
again, you know, Wahhabism is a modern movement.
Wahhabism is a very modern
Again, that period in the 19th century is a fascinating period for lots of religious reform efforts to modernize, to cleanse, to achieve dignity, and so on and so forth. So if you look at the history, you will find even the Islamic Brotherhood emerges at this time. And these are very modern, they're responding to very modern problems. This is what I always try and like communicate to people, is that they may have a rhetoric or discourse that sounds very puritanical and ancient lineage, but they're all responding to modernity as it was unfolding at a certain period in time under colonialism, and the problems they felt they could only address, the political problems, and through that. So you can, you know, people have forgotten where these movements come from, what they were reacting to, what, you know, how they see the world. In fact, there was a very interesting documentary that Adam Curtis of BBC did that linked the Islamic Brotherhood movement and the conservative movement in the US, which emerged simultaneously. In fact, the founder of the Islamic Brotherhood movement was actually living in the US. He started it here because of the currents and influences that he received. So there's lots of interesting ways to peel apart this rhetoric that comes at you, right, through these kind of hard voices. And then you just sit down and say, okay, well, did you realize that, you know, here's what's happening. This is all very recent. It's all very modern. It has some very specific political drivers and thinking. And, you know, you look at the people who were influenced, what the influences were, and things like that. So it helps put some of it in context and doesn't make it so, at least for me, it helps, you know, move the discussion away from the framework they use, which is a fight for purity versus modernity, and you're like,
but
you know,
it's also, right? But that's a hard battle to those
exactly
that are in it,
yeah,
because everything is the religious motivation. Everything is religion. Everything is God. Everything is religion. Exactly. So therefore, you telling me about your external exactly motivations, that's heresy.
Right. But it's very interesting to unravel their belief that what they're saying or practicing or arguing is unchanged from time immemorial, and by showing them that actually this is not the case at all. Like, this is a modern, you know. So it's a very, that's the way I try to get into that, because I can't argue with them on the religion But I can argue with them on why certain things are stressed and other things are not stressed, and how they were interpreted differently. Like even the death penalty, for example, a lot of people today in Pakistan, because it was made so important, argue that death penalty is Islamic. And then you can show and argue with them, well, actually, that doesn't make any sense, because many times in history, for the same crimes, societies have chosen not to perform. They've taken ethical lessons away from the Quran rather than simply penal lessons. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference.
Oh, yeah.
There is no... Right. It's clearly that we use religion to implement our... Yes, and we implement. You know, it's the how do we say it? You know, the guy who shoots the arrow and then draws the target around it afterwards. People think that that's a nice little anecdote, but no, that is the way almost we always work. Almost everybody, almost all the time. We arrive at a conclusion. Yes, we arrive at a conclusion, and then we find justifications all over the place. You're familiar with the Quran and everything, I'm assuming. Yes, cool. So, two things which are interesting to me, somebody had mentioned slightly before, so I bring it in. As far as I know, most Islamic scholars would say that the sacrifice, Abraham supposedly sacrifices his son.
Right.
So In the Torah, of course, it says that it's Isaac. Mm. It's Isahak, I guess. And in the Quran, it doesn't say anything, as far as I know. But by some people recently, it's Ishmael.
I think the Quran says it's Isaiah. It's Isa.
I don't think it's
the same narrative. It has to be.
So if I've spoken to any number of Muslims who've told me, of course.
It has to be the same narrative.
We'll say Ishmael, they think?
Yes. Yes. And I think any scholar that I know will say, if anything, that comes much, much later, but it's not explicit. But you think that it does say it in the... Okay, I want
to
check.
The Quran many, many times refers back to the Old Testament. So it has to be the same. I'm not sure why, but this is an Old Testament story, though.
Yes.
So it's... I don't see why they would...
This is what I've been told, and it's fascinating to me.
But that would be really bizarre.
It would be bizarre.
Yeah, because
right?
It would be bizarre.
It
would be strange. Because there are many, many like verses in the Quran that talk about, like, it doesn't go into details or about the Old Testament, just says, we have sent that message to you before.
Right.
Go get it over there. And so, if I'm getting it from there, it has to be this. Yeah.
It has to be.
We need not repeat.
The
precisely.
Other thing is that the midnight journey on Al-Barak supposedly takes place from Jerusalem.
Yeah, it takes place from the Dome of the Rock,
right.
That stone.
As far as I know, again, speaking to some Islamic scholars, that doesn't say that anywhere.
Yeah, it doesn't, because, first of all, the Prophet is not supposed to have performed any miracles.
Oh, you're saying the entire...
Yeah, I mean, Muhammad has never performed any miracles.
It doesn't say that. The whole midnight journey is not mentioned at all.
Yeah,
even in the hadith, in the hadith or nothing.
One of the distinctive things about the Prophet is, and it's well recognized by everyone, that he's a man, and he performed no miracles. And then, in fact, it's one of the elements of tremendous pride for Muslims. Yeah, he was. So the story or the narrative of his journey on the horse to go and see God is a mythic story. Again, hadiths are, there are many versions of the hadith, right? So it's hard, but it's not in the, it can't be in the Quran, because it's not relevant to...
It wouldn't, right.
Yeah, it wouldn't, the Quran doesn't work on mythic, there are no mythic stories in the book.
So where do we find this inscription of it, having to...
There are a series of mythic stories of miracles being performed by the Prophet that have been added on over many centuries, but I don't know what the source of them would be. This is obviously one of the more famous. You know, the other ones, like the moon divided itself into two, and the such stories. I'm not sure where they come from, but...
Well, it could be, as we spoke about, from the other religions and other cultures,
yeah,
which somehow
are
much more into
that. You know, there are religions before Christianity which have lots of narratives about the great floods and about babies being rolled down rivers and about, you know, resurrections, you know, immaculate conception. Yeah. So I don't know where these myths have come from, but they are not in the Quran. Like, the Quran doesn't give you any of these kind of stories. It's a series of very specific, you know, codes and ethical rules and instructions. It's not unlike, you know, the New Testament. It doesn't have a lot of narrative stories in it, and certainly none about, because the Prophet is purely a conveyor of a message. There's nothing that would, you know, be focused on.
It's also fascinating how progressive that the Quran is. I mean, you're saying about murder, about the death penalty, rather. Treatment of women is quite progressive.
Yeah, it's quite progressive. And also, it plays a lot of focus on forgiveness, which people, you know, the same guys who are fighting for death penalties ignore. And say, you know, I understand that it says that the penalty for theft is death, but right after that it says, but the greatest in the eyes of God is forgiveness. Okay, so let's just keep going on that same verse. And, yeah, exactly. So they just stop at the, okay, it's death. But no. He's saying also that in the eyes of God, what he respects the most is forgiveness.
Right. So this is right. I mean, look. You know, it comes. I mean, another progressive thing, if I remember correctly, is what's it called? If you have not an honor killing, but if you have a blood feud, so it's supposed to end after one. Okay, you're going to kill. You kill one. You kill one.
Kill someone?
No. And then it's fine, and then it ends there. So it's very progressive, because we go on for generations, or endless, right? So,
sure.
It's very progressive.
How, you know, we, and so the one of the arguments, you know, for like a modernist is that you need to, they're ethical lessons, not literal lessons, because of a certain time. So you look at the same ethical leap given our modernity that the Quran made given that period, and apply it to today, not just the literal. Yeah, we have to be open-minded, given context.
Right, and I can understand where people will not agree with that at all. Because then where is it? Where does it stop? Where does it stop? It's a slippery slope. You know, if you're saying that it means something, you know, who are you to judge?
Right.
Exactly. What that distance is? Or who are you to judge? Or what's the application?
That if it's the final message, then that's the final message.
And especially in Islam, that's the final message. He's the seal of the Prophet.
Exactly. Let
it flow through you, brother.
It's supposed to be perfect. Final.
Yeah.
It creates
perfect.
There are lots of counter arguments that, you know, still emerge. So.
But the idea of perfection is also very important.
It is,
right? Very important in Islam. I think the monotheism that Islam has is much more perfect than Christianity, and for sure Christianity, but even in Judaism. It's much more abstract and much more austere, if I'm not mistaken, in its perfection. It's almost a Greek perfection in a certain way. And it might have been somewhat influenced by the great Islamic scholars that were influenced by the Greeks.
More scientifically perfect, you mean?
I don't know, this idea of absolutes.
Yeah, absolutes.
You know, this like Greek idea of absolutes and perfection, absolutes. You know, God isn't, you know, it used to be God is everything. Then by the Greeks, things are like God is the only thing or something. And then, of course, you get into problems. I mean, I'm speaking, I have no clue what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah,
but
I'm not, religion is not what I really focus on. I'm more interested in, you know, political, secular.
For Bin Laden being there, you know, for the, I think the United States, wouldn't we be very angry at Pakistan for harboring the terrorist number one?
First of all, the question is harboring. Who harbored it? Was it the local government? Was it government at all? Was it just certain people?
And who knew what?
Who knew what? And maybe, well, you want to say maybe the Americans knew he was there. Just came some at a certain point that we say, okay, we gotta. I don't.
Yeah,
I know. So
we need a new story.
I know. I try and work with. Yeah, public information. I don't know what the, you know. These are all dark state issues. I have no idea. You know, I don't even know if they even killed him. I could say that maybe they did take him. He's in a prison somewhere. They just told you that we just throw you in the ocean so that we wouldn't bother to give him due process.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and they've got him stacked away somewhere.
You know what's his name? Did this film called The Tillman Story? You know, Amir Barlev. Whatever, okay. Amir Barlev did a film called The Tillman Story. Tillman, he was a football player, and he, with some patriotic fervor, went and signed up for the and he fought it was in Afghanistan, I think, or Iraq.
He died.
And he died. It turned out that he was killed by friendly fire. Until that came out, was like, and they had constructed this very patriotic, and it seems that letters he was writing home, he was disillusioned, and he was, you know, but that didn't fit with the... The grand narrative.
Did he want to become an Islamic terrorist, or what did he want to do?
No. The question is, we don't have to say that the American government killed him to somehow still come through with a strong point.
Given that we know nothing, I could make up a whole different story about, you know, Bin Laden was bored living in Abbottabad. He wanted a penthouse in D.C., and they were like, all right, whatever. We'll fake a killing and fly you out. Now he's living there, as, you know, shopping down the mall.
He's this man of many... He used to be this, I don't know, playboy, whatever, in an earlier incarnation. You know.
50 kids.
Well, no, I don't mean it that way. I mean more...
I've known with the CIA for many years. He had a great time. Now maybe he's, you know... What do I know? Maybe he's, you know, Bush is painting these. Maybe he's painting Bin Laden. No, shave. I don't know.
But I will say something that... what percentage of what percentage of the world were okay with September 11th, 2001? And how many would, if there wouldn't have been deaths, how many would have been happened if the World Trade Centers fell? And I would say probably 90% of the world population. I think this perspective that we have that America is so loved by everyone is just...
Their histories.
I'm saying you don't think the French would have been happy if the United States got a big, crushing blow, black eye. You don't think
Twin Tower, World Trade Center,
I'm saying without deaths, if there would have just been the, you know, a crushing, you know, punch in the nose, red eye, black eye. I think again, this perspective.
As a 10-year-old. Who I was filming 2 weeks afterwards.
I was about to say, well, you were 10 in 2001.
No. Who I was filming two weeks afterwards, who lived in Soho, said it was like New York and the United States had its two front teeth knocked out, which is the best description I...
Well said.
That was from a 10-year-old. So shall we continue our voyage?
Yes, we shall.
Okay. Oy vezik.